One wrote, "Oh yes, I went to the white man's schools. I learned to read from school books, newspapers, and the Bible. But in time I found that these were not enough. Civilized people depend too much on man-made printed pages. I turned to the Great Spirit's book, which is the whole of his creation." A Hopi Indian named Sun Chief said, "I had learned many English words and could recite part of the Ten Commandments. I knew how to sleep on a bed, pray to Jesus, comb my hair, eat with a knife and fork, and use a toilet. I had also learned that a person thinks with his head instead of his heart." Chief Luther Standing Bear, in his 1933 autobiography, From the Land of the Spotted Eagle, wrote, "True, the white man brought great change, but the varied fruits of his civilization, though highly colored and inviting, are sickening and deadening, and if it be part of the civilization to maim, rob, and thwart, then what is progress? I am going to venture that the man who sat on the ground in his teepee, meditating on life and its meaning, accepting the kinship of all creatures, and acknowledging unity with the universe of things, was infusing into his being the true essence of civilization." As the civil rights and anti-war movements developed in the 1960s, Indians were already gathering their energy for resistance, thinking about how to change their situation, beginning to organize. In 1961, 500 tribal and urban Indian leaders met in Chicago. Out of this came another gathering of university-educated young Indians who formed the National Indian Youth Council. Mel Tom, a Paiute Indian, their first president, wrote, "There is increased activity over on the Indian side. There are disagreements, laughing, singing, outbursts of anger, and occasionally some planning. Indians are gaining confidence and courage that their cause is right. The struggle goes on. Indians are gathering together to deliberate their destiny." Around this time, Indians began to approach the United States government on an embarrassing topic, treaties. In his widely read 1969 book, Custer Died for Your Sins, Vine Deloria Jr. noted that President Lyndon Johnson talked about America's commitments, and President Nixon talked about Russia's failure to respect treaties. He said, "Indian people laugh themselves sick when they hear those statements." The United States government had signed more than 400 treaties with Indians and violated every single one. For instance, back in George Washington's administration, a treaty was signed with the Iroquois of New York. "The United States acknowledge all the land within the aforementioned boundaries to be the property of the Seneca Nation." But in the early 60s, under President Kennedy, the United States ignored the treaty and built a dam on this land, flooding most of the Seneca Reservation. Resistance was already taking shape in various parts of the country. In the state of Washington, there was an old treaty taking land from the Indians, but leaving them fishing rights. This became unpopular as the white population grew and wanted the fishing areas exclusively for themselves. When state courts closed river areas to Indian fishermen in 1964, Indians had fish-ins on the Nisqually River in defiance of the court orders and went to jail, hoping to publicize their protest. A local judge the following year ruled that the Puyallup tribe did not exist and its members could not fish on the river named for them, the Puyallup River. Policemen raided Indian fishing groups, destroyed boats, slashed nets, manhandled people, arrested 7 Indians. A Supreme Court ruling in 1968 confirmed Indian rights under the treaty, but said a state could regulate all fishing if it did not discriminate against Indians. The state continued to get injunctions and to arrest Indians fishing. They were doing to the Supreme Court ruling what whites in the South had done with the 14th Amendment for many years, ignoring it. Protests, raids, arrests continued into the early 70s. Some of the Indians involved in the fish-ins were veterans of the Vietnam War. One was Sid Mills, who was arrested in a fish-in at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in Washington on October 13, 1968. He made a statement. "I am a Yakima and Cherokee Indian and a man. For 2 years and 4 months, I've been a soldier in the United States Army. I served in combat in Vietnam until critically wounded. I hereby renounce further obligation in service or duty to the United States Army. My first obligation now lies with the Indian people fighting for the lawful treaty to fish in usual and accustomed water of the Nisqually, Columbia, and other rivers of the Pacific Northwest, and in serving them in this fight in any way possible. My decision is influenced by the fact that we have already buried Indian fishermen returned dead from Vietnam, while Indian fishermen live here without protection and under steady attack. Just 3 years ago today, on October 13, 1965, 19 women and children were brutalized by more than 45 armed agents of the state of Washington at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in a vicious, unwarranted attack. Interestingly, the oldest human skeletal remains ever found in the Western Hemisphere were recently uncovered on the banks of the Columbia River, the remains of Indian fishermen. What kind of government or society would spend millions of dollars to pick upon our bones, restore our ancestral life patterns, and protect our ancient remains from damage, while at the same time eating upon the flesh of our living people? We will fight for our rights." Indians fought back not only with physical resistance, but also with the artifacts of white culture, books, words, newspapers. In 1968, members of the Mohawk Nation at Akwesane on the St. Lawrence River between the United States and Canada began a remarkable newspaper, Akwesane Notes, with news, editorials, poetry, all flaming with the spirit of defiance. Mixed in with all that was an irrepressible humor. Vine Deloria Jr. wrote, "Every now and then I am impressed with the thinking of the non-Indian. I was in Cleveland last year and got to talking with a non-Indian about American history. He said that he was really sorry about what had happened to Indians, but that there was a good reason for it. The continent had to be developed, and he felt that Indians had stood in the way, and thus it had to be removed. After all," he remarked, "what did you do with the land when you had it?" I didn't understand him until later, when I discovered that the Cuyahoga River, running through Cleveland, is inflammable. So many combustible pollutants are dumped into the river that the inhabitants have to take special precautions during the summer to avoid setting it on fire. After reviewing the argument of my non-Indian friend, I decided that he was probably correct. Whites had made better use of the land. How many Indians could have thought of creating an inflammable river? In 1969, November 9th, there took place a dramatic event which focused attention on Indian grievances as nothing else had. It burst through the invisibility of previous local Indian protests and declared to the entire world that the Indians still lived and would fight for their rights. On that day before dawn, 78 Indians landed on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay and occupied the island. Alcatraz was an abandoned federal prison, a hated and terrible place, nicknamed The Rock. In 1964, some young Indians had occupied it to establish an Indian university, but they were driven off and there was no publicity. This time it was different. The group was led by Richard Oakes, a Mohawk, who directed Indian studies at San Francisco State College, and Grace Thorpe, a Sac and Fox Indian, daughter of Jim Thorpe, the famous Indian college football star and Olympic runner, jumper, hurdler. More Indians landed, and by the end of November, nearly 600 of them, representing more than 50 tribes, were living on Alcatraz. They called themselves Indians of all tribes, and issued a proclamation. "We hold the Rock." In it, they offered to buy Alcatraz in glass beads and red cloth, the price paid Indians for Manhattan Island over 300 years earlier. They said, We feel that this so-called Alcatraz Island is more suitable for an Indian reservation, as determined by the white man's own standards. By this we mean that this place resembles most Indian reservations in that, 1. It is isolated from modern facilities and without adequate means of transportation. 2. It has no fresh running water. 3. It has inadequate sanitation facilities. 4. There are no oil or mineral rights. 5. There is no industry, and so unemployment is very great. 6. There are no healthcare facilities. 7. The soil is rocky and non-productive, and the land does not support game. 8. There are no educational facilities. 9. The population has always exceeded the land base. 10. The population has always been held prisoners and dependent upon others. They announced they would make the island a center for Native American studies for ecology. We will work to depollute the air and waters of the Bay Area, restore fish and animal life. In the months that followed, the government cut off telephones, electricity, and water to Alcatraz Island. Many of the Indians had to leave, but others insisted on staying. A year later, they were still there, and they sent out a message to our brothers and sisters of all races and tongues upon our Earth Mother. We are still holding the island of Alcatraz in the true names of freedom, justice, and equality, because you, our brothers and sisters of this earth, have lent support to our just cause. We reach out our hands and hearts and send spirit messages to each and every one of you. We hold the rock. We have learned that violence breeds only more violence, and we therefore have carried on our occupation of Alcatraz in a peaceful manner, hoping that the government of these United States will also act accordingly. We are a proud people. We are Indians. We have observed and rejected much of what so-called civilization offers. We are Indians. We will preserve our traditions and ways of life by educating our own children. We are Indians. We will join hands in a unity never before put into practice. We are Indians. Our Earth Mother awaits our voices. We are Indians of all tribes. We hold the rock. 6 months later, federal forces invaded the island and physically removed the Indians living there. It had been thought that the Navajo Indians would not be heard from again. In the mid-1800s, United States troops under Kit Carson burned Navajo villages, destroyed their crops and orchards, forced them from their lands. But in the Black Mesa of New Mexico, they never surrendered. In the late 1960s, the Peabody Coal Company began strip mining on their land, a ruthless excavation of the topsoil. The company pointed to a contract signed with some Navajos. It was reminiscent of the treaty signed with some Indians in the past that took away all Indian land. 150 Navajos met in the spring of 1969 to declare that the strip mining would pollute the water and the air, destroy the grazing land for livestock, use up their scarce water resources. A young woman pointed to a public relations pamphlet put out by the Peabody Coal Company, showing fishing lakes, grassland, trees, and said, "We're not going to have anything like those you see in the pictures. What is the future going to be like for our children, our children's children?" An elderly Navajo woman, one of the organizers of the meeting, said, "Peabody's monsters are digging up the heart of our Mother Earth, our sacred mountain, and we also feel the pains. I have lived here for years, and I'm not about to move." The Hopi Indians were also affected by the Peabody operations. They wrote to President Nixon in protest. "Today, the sacred lands where the Hopi live are being desecrated by men who seek coal and water from our soil, that they may create more power for the white man's cities. The Great Spirit said not to allow this to happen. The Great Spirit said not to take from the earth, not to destroy living things. It is said by the Great Spirit that if a gourd of ashes is dropped upon the earth, that many men will die and that the end of this way of life is near at hand. We interpret this as the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We do not want to see this happen to any place or any nation again, but instead we should turn all this energy for peaceful uses, not for war." In the fall of 1970, a magazine called La Raza, one of the countless local publications coming out of the movements of those years to supply information ignored in the regular media, told about the Pitt River Indians of Northern California. 60 Pitt Indians occupied land they said belonged to them. They defied the Forest Services when ordered to leave. One of them, Darrell B. Wilson, later recalled, "As the flames danced orange, making the trees come to life, and the cold creeped out of the darkness to challenge the speaking fire, and our breath came in small clouds, we spoke. They asked the government by what treaty it claimed the land. It could point to none. They cited a federal statute, 25 U.S.C.A. 194, that where there was a land dispute between Indian and white, the burden of proof falls on the white man. They had built a Quonset hut, and the marshals told them it was ugly and ruined the landscape." Wilson wrote later, "The whole world is rotting. The water is poisoned, the air polluted, the politics deformed, the land gutted, the forest pillaged, the shores ruined, the towns burned, the lives of the people destroyed. And the Federals spent the best part of October trying to tell us the Quonset hut was ugly. To us it was beautiful. It was the beginning of our school, the meeting place, home for our homeless, a sanctuary for those needing rest, our church, our headquarters, our business office, our symbol of approaching freedom, and it still stands. It was also the center for the reviving of our stricken, diluted, and separated culture, our beginning. It was our sun rising on a clear spring day when the sky holds no clouds. It was a good and pure thing for the heart to look upon. That small place on earth, our place." But 150 marshals came with machine guns, shotguns, rifles, pistols, riot sticks, mace, dogs, chains, manacles. The old people were frightened. The young questioned bravery. The small children were like a deer that has been shot by the thunderstick. Hearts beat fast as though a race was just run in the heat of summer. The marshals began swinging their riot sticks and blood started flowing. Wilson grabbed one marshal's club, was thrown down, manacled, and while lying face down on the ground was struck behind the head several times. A 60-year-old man was beaten into unconsciousness. A white reporter was arrested, his wife beaten. They were all thrown into trucks and taken away, charged with assaulting state and federal officers and cutting trees, but not with trespassing, which might have brought into question the ownership of the land. When the episode was all over, they were still defiant. Indians who had been in the Vietnam War made connections. At the Winter Soldier Investigations in Detroit, where Vietnam veterans testified about their experiences, an Oklahoma Indian named Evan Haney told about this. "The same massacres happened to the Indians 100 years ago. Germ warfare was used then. They put smallpox in the Indians' blankets. I got to know the Vietnamese people, and I learned they were just like us. What we are doing is destroying ourselves and the world. I have grown up with racism all my life. When I was a child, watching cowboys and Indians on TV, I would root for the cavalry, not the Indians. It was that bad. I was that far toward my own destruction." Though 50% of the children at the country school I attended in Oklahoma were Indians, nothing in school, on television, or on the radio taught anything about Indian culture. There were no books on Indian history, not even in the library. But I knew something was wrong. I started reading and learning my own culture. I saw the Indian people at their happiest when they went to Alcatraz or to Washington to defend their fishing rights. They at last felt like human beings. Indians began to do something about their own destruction, the annihilation of their culture. In 1969, at the first convocation of American Indian scholars, Indians spoke indignantly of either the ignoring or the insulting of Indians in textbooks given to little children all over the United States. That year, the Indian Historian Press was founded. It evaluated 400 textbooks in elementary and secondary schools and found that not one of them gave an accurate depiction of the Indian. A counterattack began in the schools. In early 1971, 45 Indian students at Copper Valley School in Glen Allen, Alaska, wrote a letter to their congressman opposing the Alaska oil pipeline as ruinous to the ecology, a threat to the peace, quiet, and security of our Alaska. Other Americans were beginning to pay attention, to rethink their own learning. The first motion pictures attempting to redress the history of the Indian appeared. One was Little Big Man, based on a novel by Thomas Berger. More and more books appeared on Indian history, until a whole new literature came into existence. Teachers became sensitive to the old stereotypes, threw away the old textbooks, started using new material. In the spring of 1977, a teacher named Jane Califf in the New York City elementary schools told of her experiences with fourth and fifth grade students. She brought into class the traditional textbooks and asked the students to locate the stereotypes in them. She read aloud from Native American writers and articles from Akwesane Notes and put protest posters around the room. The children then wrote letters to the editors of the books they had read. "Dear editor, I don't like your book called The Cruise of Christopher Columbus. I didn't like it because you said some things about Indians that weren't true. Another thing I didn't like was on page 69. It says that Christopher Columbus invited the Indians to Spain, but what really happened was that he stole them. Sincerely, Raymond Miranda." On Thanksgiving Day, 1970, at the annual celebration of the landing of the Pilgrims, the authorities decided to do something different, invite an Indian to make the celebratory speech. They found a Wampanoag Indian named Frank James and asked him to speak. But when they saw the speech he was about to deliver, they decided they did not want it. His speech, not heard at Plymouth, Massachusetts on that occasion, said in part, the whole speech is in Chronicles of American Indian Protest, "I speak to you as a man, a Wampanoag man. It is with mixed emotions that I stand here to share my thoughts. The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores of Cape Cod 4 days before they had robbed the graves of my ancestors and stolen their corn, wheat, and beans. Our spirit refuses to die. Yesterday we walked the woodland paths and sandy trails. Today we must walk the macadam highways and roads. We are uniting. We are standing not in our wigwams, but in your concrete tent. We stand tall and proud, and before too many moons pass, we'll right the wrongs we have allowed to happen to us." For Indians, there has never been a clear line between prose and poetry. When an Indian studying in New Mexico was praised for his poetry, he said, "In my tribe, we have no poets. Everyone talks in poetry." There are, however, poems collected in William Brandon's The Last Americans, and in The Way by Shirley Hill Witt and Stan Steiner. In Anishinaabe Spring Poem, translated by Gerald Weisenar, "As my eyes look across the prairie, I feel the summer in the spring." Snow the Last by Joseph Concha, "Snow comes last, for it quiets down everything." This from a fifth-year group in a special Navajo program in the year 1940 called It Is Not. "The Navajo Reservation a lonesome place? It is not. The skies are sunny, clear blue or gray with rain. Each day is gay in nature's way. It is not a lonesome place at all, a Navajo house, shabby and small. It is not. Inside there's love, good laughter, and big talk. But best, it's home, with an open door and room for all. A castle could have no more." In March of 1973 came a powerful affirmation that the Indians of North America were still alive. On the site of the 1890 massacre on Pine Ridge Reservation, several hundred Oglala Sioux and friends returned to the village of Wounded Knee to occupy it as a symbol of the demand for Indian land, Indian rights. The history of that event, in the words of the participants, has been captured in a rare book published by Akwesane Notes, Voices from Wounded Knee, 1973. In the 1970s, 54% of the adult males on the Pine Ridge Reservation were unemployed. One-third of the families were on welfare or pensions. Alcoholism was widespread, and suicide rates were high. The life expectancy of an Oglala Sioux was 46 years. Just before the Wounded Knee occupation, there was violence at the town of Custer. An Indian named Wesley Badheart Bull was killed by a white gas station attendant. The man was let out on a $5,000 bond and indicted for manslaughter, facing a possible 10-year term. A gathering of Indians to protest this led to a clash with police. The murder victim's mother, Mrs. Sarah Badheart Bull, was arrested on charges that called for a maximum sentence of 30 years. On February 27, 1973, about 300 Oglala Sioux, many of them members of the new militant organization called the American Indian Movement, AIM, entered the village of Wounded Knee and declared it liberated territory. Ellen Move's camp later said, "We decided that we did need the American Indian Movement in here because our men were scared. They hung to the back. It was mostly the women that went forward and spoke out." Within hours, more than 200 FBI agents, federal marshals, and police of the Bureau of Indian Affairs surrounded and blockaded the town. They had armored vehicles, automatic rifles, machine guns, grenade launchers, and gas shells, and soon began firing. Gladys Bissonette said 3 weeks later, "Since we are here in Wounded Knee, we've been shot at over and over, always after dark. But last night we were hit the hardest. I guess the Great Spirit is with us, and no bullets find their way into our bodies. We ran through a hail of bullets one night. We're going to hold our stand until we are completely an independent sovereign nation, Oglala Sioux Nation." After the siege began, food supplies became short. Indians in Michigan sent food via a plane that landed inside the encampment. The next day, FBI agents arrested the pilot and a doctor from Michigan who had hired the plane. In Nevada, 11 Indians were arrested for taking food, clothing, and medical supplies to South Dakota. In mid-April, three more planes dropped 1,200 pounds of food. But as people scrambled to gather it up, a government helicopter appeared overhead and fired down on them while ground fire came from all sides. Frank Clearwater, an Indian man lying on a cot inside a church, was hit by a bullet. When his wife accompanied him to a hospital, she was arrested and jailed. Clearwater died. There were more gun battles, another death. Finally, a negotiated peace was signed in which both sides agreed to disarm. The Indians had refused to disarm while surrounded by armed men, recalling the 1890 massacre. The United States government promised to investigate Indian affairs, and a presidential commission would re-examine the 1868 treaty. The siege ended, and 120 occupiers were arrested. The U.S. government then said that it had re-examined the 1868 treaty, found it valid, but that it was superseded by the U.S. power of eminent domain, the government's power to take land. The Indians had held out for 71 days, creating a marvelous community inside the besieged territory. Communal kitchens were set up, a health clinic and hospital. A Navajo Vietnam veteran. There's a tremendous amount of coolness considering that we're outgunned. But people stay because they believe they have a cause. That's why we lost in Vietnam, because there was no cause. We were fighting a rich man's war for the rich man. In Wounded Knee, we're doing pretty damn good morale-wise, because we can still laugh. Messages of support came to Wounded Knee from Australia, Finland, Germany, Italy, Japan, England. One message came from some of the Attica brothers, two of whom were Indians. "You fight for our Earth Mother and her children. Our spirits fight with you." Wallace Black Elk replied, Little Wounded Knee is turned into a giant world. After Wounded Knee, in spite of the deaths, the trials, the use of the police and courts to try to break the movement, the Native American movement continued. In the Akwesane community itself, which put out Akwesane Notes, the Indians had always insisted their territory was separate, not to be invaded by the white man's law. One day, New York State police gave 3 traffic tickets to a Mohawk Indian truck driver, and a council of Indians met with a police lieutenant. At first, he insisted that he had to follow orders and give out tickets, even in Akwesane territory, although he obviously was trying to be reasonable. He finally agreed that they would not arrest an Indian in the territory, or even outside of it, without first having a meeting with the Mohawk council. The lieutenant then sat down and lit a cigar. Indian Chief Joaquiso, a distinguished-looking man with long hair, rose and addressed the lieutenant with a serious voice. "There is one more thing before you go," he said, looking straight at the lieutenant. "I want to know," he said slowly, "if you've got an extra cigar." The meeting ended in laughter. Akwesane Notes continued to publish. On its poetry page, late autumn 1976, appeared poems reflecting the spirit of the times. Isla Abernathy wrote, "I am grass growing and the shearer of grass. I am the willow and the splitter of laths, weaver and the thing woven, marriage of willow and grass. I am frost on the land and the land's life, breath and beast and the sharp rock underfoot. In me the mountain lives and the owl strikes, and I in them. I am the sun's twin, mover of blood and the blood lost. I am the deer and the deer's death. I am the burr in your conscience. Acknowledge me." And Buffy St. Marie, "You think I have visions because I'm an Indian. I have visions because there are visions to be seen." In the 60s and 70s, it was not just a women's movement, a prisoners movement, an Indian movement. There was general revolt against oppressive, artificial, previously unquestioned ways of living. It touched every aspect of personal life, childbirth, childhood, love, sex, marriage, dress, music, art, sports, language, food, housing, religion, literature, death, schools. The new temper, the new behavior shocked many Americans. It created tensions. Sometimes it was seen as a generation gap, the younger generation moving far away from the older one in its way of life. But it seemed after a while to be not so much a matter of age. Some young people remained straight, while some middle-aged people were changing their ways, and old people were beginning to behave in ways that astounded others. Sexual behavior went through startling changes. Premarital sex was no longer a matter for silence. Men and women lived together outside of marriage and struggled for words to describe the other person when introduced. "I want you to meet my friend." Married couples candidly spoke of their affairs, and books appeared discussing open marriage. Masturbation could be talked about openly, even approvingly. Homosexuality was no longer concealed. Gay men and gay women, lesbians, organized to combat discrimination against them, to give themselves a sense of community, to overcome shame and isolation. All this was reflected in the literature and in the mass media. Court decisions overruled the local banning of books that were erotic or even pornographic. A new literature appeared, The Joy of Sex and Others, to teach men and women how sexual fulfillment could be attained. The movies now did not hesitate to show nudity, although the motion picture industry, wanting to preserve principle as well as profit, set up a classification system, R for restricted, X for prohibited to children. The language of sex became more common both in literature and in ordinary conversation. All this was connected with new living arrangements. Especially among young people, communal living arrangements flourished. A few were truly communes, that is, based on the sharing of money and decisions, creating a community of intimacy, affection, trust. Most were practical arrangements for sharing the rent, with varying degrees of friendship and intimate association among the participants. It was no longer unusual for men and women to be roommates in groups of two or three or larger and without sexual relations as practical, unself-conscious arrangements. The most important thing about dress in the cultural change of the 60s was the greater informality. For women, it was a continuation of the historic feminist movement's insistence on discarding of feminine, hampering clothes. Many women stopped wearing bras. The restrictive girdle, almost a uniform of the 40s and 50s, became rare. Young men and women dressed more nearly alike, in jeans, in discarded army uniforms. Men stopped wearing neckties. Women of all ages wore pants more often, unspoken homage to Amelia Bloomer. There was a new popular music of protest. Pete Seeger had been singing protest songs since the 40s, but now he came into his own, his audiences much larger. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez singing not only protest songs, but songs reflecting the new abandon, the new culture, became popular idols. A middle-aged woman on the West Coast, Malvina Reynolds, wrote and sang songs that fit her socialist thinking and her libertarian spirit, as well as her critique of the modern commercial culture. Everybody now, she sang, lived in little boxes, and they all came out just the same. Bob Dylan was a phenomenon unto himself, powerful songs of protest, personal songs of freedom and self-expression. In an angry song, Masters of War, he hopes that one day they will die and he will follow their casket in the pale afternoon. A hard rain's a gonna fall recounts the terrible stories of the last decades of starvation and war and tears and dead ponies and poisoned waters and damp, dirty prisons. It's a hard rain's a gonna fall. Dylan sang a bitter anti-war song, With God on Our Side, and one about the killer of the black activist, Medgar Evers, only a pawn in their game. He offered a challenge to the old, hope to the new, for the times they are a-changin'. The Catholic upsurge against the war was part of a general revolt inside the Catholic Church, which had for so long been a bulwark of conservatism, tied to racism, jingoism, war. Priests and nuns resigned from the church, opened their lives to sex, got married and had children, sometimes without bothering to leave the church officially. True, there was still enormous popularity for the old-time religious revivalists, and Billy Graham commanded the obedience of millions, but now there were small, swift currents against the mainstream. There was a new suspicion of big business, of profiteering as the motive for ruining the environment. There was a re-examination of the death industry, of money-making funerals and profitable tombstones, as in Jessica Midford's The American Way of Death. With the loss of faith in big powers, business, government, religion, there arose a stronger belief in self, whether individual or collective. The experts in all fields were now looked at skeptically. The belief grew that people could figure out for themselves what to eat, how to live their lives, how to be healthy. There was suspicion of the medical industry and campaigns against chemical preservatives, valueless foods, advertising. By now, the scientific evidence of the evils of smoking, cancer, heart disease, was so powerful that the government barred advertising of cigarettes on television and in newspapers. Traditional education began to be re-examined. The schools had taught whole generations the values of patriotism, of obeying authority, and had perpetuated ignorance, even contempt for people of other nations, races, Native Americans, women. Not just the content of education was challenged, but the style, the formality, the bureaucracy, the insistence on subordination to authority. This made only a small dent in the formidable national system of Orthodox education, but it was reflected in a new generation of teachers all over the country, and a new literature to sustain them. Jonathan Kozol, Death at an Early Age, George Denison, The Lives of Children, Ivan Illich, De-schooling Society. Never in American history had more movements for change been concentrated in so short a span of years. But the system in the course of two centuries had learned a good deal about the control of people. In the mid-70s, it went to work. Chapter 20, The 70s, Under Control. In the early 70s, the system seemed out of control. It could not hold the loyalty of the public. As early as 1970, according to the University of Michigan's Survey Research Center, trust in government was low in every section of the population, and there was a significant difference by class. Of professional people, 40% had low political trust in the government. Of unskilled blue-collar workers, 66% had low trust. Public opinion surveys in 1971, after 7 years of intervention in Vietnam, showed an unwillingness to come to the aid of other countries, assuming they were attacked by communist-backed forces. Even for countries allied to the United States in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or Mexico, right on our southern border, there was no majority opinion for intervening with American troops. As for Thailand, if it were under communist attack, only 12% of whites interrogated would send troops, 4% of non-whites would do so. In the summer of 1972, anti-war people in the Boston area were picketing Honeywell Corporation. The literature they distributed pointed out that Honeywell was producing anti-personnel weapons used in Vietnam, like the deadly cluster bomb that had riddled thousands of Vietnamese civilians with painful, hard-to-extricate pellets. About 600 ballots were given to the Honeywell employees, asking if they thought that Honeywell should discontinue making these weapons. Of the 231 persons who returned the ballots, 131 said that Honeywell should stop. 88 said it should not. They were invited to make comments. A typical no comment. Honeywell is not responsible for what the Department of Defense does with the goods it buys. A typical yes comment. How may we have pride in our work when the entire basis for this work is immoral? The Survey Research Center of the University of Michigan had been posing the question, is the government run by a few big interests looking out for themselves? The answer in 1964 had been yes from 26% of those polled. By 1972, the answer was yes from 53% of those polled. An article in the American Political Science Review by Arthur H. Miller, reporting on the extensive polling done by Survey Research Center, said that the poll showed widespread basic discontent and political alienation. He added, political scientists often took on the worries of the establishment. What is startling and somewhat alarming is the rapid degree of change in this basic attitude over a period of only 6 years. More voters than ever before refuse to identify themselves as either Democrats or Republicans. Back in 1940, 20% of those polled called themselves independents. In 1974, 34% called themselves independents. The courts, the juries, and even judges were not behaving as usual. Juries were acquitting radicals. Angela Davis, an acknowledged communist, was acquitted by an all-white jury on the West Coast. Black Panthers, whom the government had tried in every way to malign and destroy, were freed by juries in several trials. A judge in western Massachusetts threw out a case against a young activist, Sam Lovejoy, who had toppled a 500-foot tower erected by a utility company trying to set up a nuclear plant. In Washington, D.C., in August 1973, a Superior Court judge refused to sentence six men charged with unlawful entry who had stepped from a White House tour line to protest the bombing of Cambodia. Undoubtedly, much of this national mood of hostility to government and business came out of the Vietnam War, its 55,000 casualties, its moral shame, its exposure of government lies and atrocities. On top of this came the political disgrace of the Nixon administration and the scandals that came to be known by the one-word label Watergate, and which led to the historic resignation from the presidency, the first in American history, of Richard Nixon in August 1974. It began during the presidential campaign in June of 1972, when five burglars carrying wiretapping and photo equipment were caught in the act of breaking into the offices of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate apartment complex of Washington, D.C. One of the five, James McCord, Jr., worked for the Nixon campaign. He was security officer for the Committee to Re-elect the President, CREEP. Another of the five had an address book in which was listed the name of E. Howard Hunt, and Hunt's address was listed at the White House. He was assistant to Charles Colson, who was special counsel to President Nixon. Both McCord and Hunt had worked for many years for the CIA. Hunt had been the CIA man in charge of the invasion of Cuba in 1961. And three of the Watergate burglars were veterans of the invasion. McCord, as CREEP security man, worked for the chief of CREEP, John Mitchell, the Attorney General of the United States. Thus, due to an unforeseen arrest by police, unaware of the high-level connections of the burglars, information was out to the public before anyone could stop it, linking the burglars to important officials in Nixon's campaign committee, to the CIA, and to Nixon's Attorney General. Mitchell denied any connection with the burglary, and Nixon, in a press conference 5 days after the event, said, "The White House has had no involvement whatever in this particular incident." What followed the next year, after a grand jury in September indicted the Watergate burglars, plus Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, was that one after another, lesser officials of the Nixon administration, fearing prosecution, began to talk. They gave information in judicial proceedings to a Senate investigating committee, to the press. They implicated not only John Mitchell, but Robert Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, Nixon's highest White House aides, and finally, Richard Nixon himself, in not only the Watergate burglaries, but a whole series of illegal actions against political opponents and anti-war activists. Nixon and his aides lied again and again as they tried to cover up their involvement. These facts came out in the various testimonies. 1. Attorney General John Mitchell controlled a secret fund of $350,000 to $700,000 to be used against the Democratic Party for forging letters, leaking false news items to the press, stealing campaign files. 2. Gulf Oil Corporation, ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph, American Airlines, and other huge American corporations had made illegal contributions running into the millions of dollars to the Nixon campaign. 3. In September of 1971, shortly after the New York Times printed Daniel Ellsberg's copies of the top-secret Pentagon Papers, the administration planned and carried out, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy themselves doing it, the burglary of the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist looking for Ellsberg's records. 4. After the Watergate burglars were caught, Nixon secretly pledged to give them executive clemency if they were imprisoned and suggested that up to $1 million be given them to keep them quiet. In fact, $450,000 was given to them on Ehrlichman's orders. 5. Nixon's nominee for head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover had recently died, L. Patrick Gray, revealed that he had turned over the FBI records on its investigation of the Watergate burglary to Nixon's legal assistant, John Dean, and that Attorney General Richard Kleindienst, Mitchell had just resigned, saying he wanted to pursue his private life, had ordered him not to discuss Watergate with the Senate Judiciary Committee. 6. Two former members of Nixon's cabinet, John Mitchell and Maurice Stans, were charged with taking $250,000 from a financier named Robert Vesco in return for their help with a Securities and Exchange Commission investigation of Vesco's activities. 7. It turned out that certain material had disappeared from FBI files, material from a series of illegal wiretaps ordered by Henry Kissinger, placed on the telephones of 4 journalists and 13 government officials, and was in the White House safe of Nixon's advisor, John Ehrlichman. 8. One of the Watergate burglars, Bernard Barker, told the Senate committee that he had also been involved in a plan to physically attack Daniel Ellsberg while Ellsberg spoke at an anti-war rally in Washington. 9. A deputy director of the CIA testified that Haldeman and Ehrlichman told him it was Nixon's wish that the CIA tell the FBI not to pursue its investigation beyond the Watergate burglary. 10. Almost by accident, a witness told the Senate committee that President Nixon had tapes of all personal conversations and phone conversations at the White House. Nixon at first refused to turn over the tapes, and when he finally did, they had been tampered with. 18.5 minutes of one tape had been erased. 11. In the midst of all this, Nixon's Vice President Spiro Agnew was indicted in Maryland for receiving bribes from Maryland contractors in return for political favors and resigned from the vice presidency in October 1973. Nixon appointed Congressman Gerald Ford to take Agnew's place. 12. Over $10 million in government money had been used by Nixon on his private homes in San Clemente and Key Biscayne on grounds of security, and he had illegally taken, with the aid of a bit of forgery, a $576,000 tax deduction for some of his papers. 13. It was disclosed that for over a year in 1969 to 1970, the U.S. had engaged in a secret, massive bombing of Cambodia, which it kept from the American people and even from Congress. It was a swift and sudden fall. In the November 1972 presidential election, Nixon and Agnew had won 60% of the popular vote and carried every state except Massachusetts, defeating an anti-war candidate, Senator George McGovern. By June of 1973, a Gallup poll showed 67% of those polled thought Nixon was involved in the Watergate break-in or lied to cover up. By the fall of 1973, 8 different resolutions had been introduced in the House of Representatives for the impeachment of President Nixon. The following year, a House committee drew up a bill of impeachment to present to a full House. Nixon's advisors told him it would pass the House by the required majority, and then the Senate would vote the necessary 2/3 majority to remove him from office. On August 8, 1974, Nixon resigned. 6 months before Nixon resigned, the business magazine, Dunn's Review, reported a poll of 300 corporation executives. Almost all had voted for Nixon in 1972. But now a majority said he should resign. Right now, 90% of Wall Street would cheer if Nixon resigns, said a vice president of Merrill Lynch Government Securities. When he did, there was a relief in all sectors of the establishment. Gerald Ford, taking Nixon's office, said, "Our long national nightmare is over." Newspapers, whether they had been for or against Nixon, liberal or conservative, celebrated the successful, peaceful culmination of the Watergate crisis. "The system is working," said a longtime strong critic of the Vietnam War, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis. The 2 journalists who had much to do with investigating and exposing Nixon, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, wrote that with Nixon's departure, there might be restoration. All of this was in a mood of relief, of gratitude. No respectable American newspaper said what was said by Claude Julien, editor of Le Monde Diplomatique, in September 1974. The elimination of Mr. Richard Nixon leaves intact all the mechanisms and all the false values which permitted the Watergate scandal. Julien noted that Nixon's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, would remain at his post. In other words, that Nixon's foreign policy would continue. That is to say, Julien wrote, that Washington will continue to support General Pinochet in Chile, General Giselle in Brazil, General Stroessner in Paraguay, etc. Months after Julien wrote this, it was disclosed that top Democratic and Republican leaders in the House of Representatives had given secret assurance to Nixon that if he resigned, they would not support criminal proceedings against him. One of them, the ranking Republican of the Judiciary Committee, said, "We had all been shuddering about what 2 weeks of televised floor debates on impeachment would do, how it would tear the country apart and affect foreign policy. The New York Times articles that reported on Wall Street's hope for Nixon's resignation quoted one Wall Street financier as saying that if Nixon resigned, what we will have is the same play with different players." When Gerald Ford, a conservative Republican who had supported all of Nixon's policies, was nominated for president, a liberal senator from California, Alan Cranston, spoke for him on the floor, saying he had polled many people, Republicans and Democrats, and found an almost startling consensus of conciliation that is developing around him. When Nixon resigned and Ford became president, the New York Times said, "Out of the despair of Watergate has come an inspiring new demonstration of the uniqueness and strength of the American democracy." A few days later, the Times wrote happily that the peaceful transfer of power brought a cleansing sense of relief to the American people. In the charges brought by the House Committee on Impeachment against Nixon, it seemed clear that the committee did not want to emphasize those elements in his behavior which were found in other presidents and which might be repeated in the future. It stayed clear of Nixon's dealings with powerful corporations. It did not mention the bombing of Cambodia. It concentrated on things peculiar to Nixon, not on fundamental policies continuous among American presidents at home and abroad. The word was out: get rid of Nixon, but keep the system. Theodore Sorensen, who had been an advisor to President Kennedy, wrote at the time of Watergate, "The underlying causes of the gross misconduct in our law enforcement system, now being revealed, are largely personal, not institutional. Some structural changes are needed. All the rotten apples should be thrown out, but save the barrel." Indeed, the barrel was saved. Nixon's foreign policy remained. The government's connections to corporate interests remained. Ford's closest friends in Washington were corporate lobbyists. Alexander Haig, who had been one of Nixon's closest advisors, who had helped in processing the tapes before turning them over to the public, and who gave the public misinformation about the tapes, was appointed by President Ford to be head of the armed forces of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. One of Ford's first acts was to pardon Nixon, thus saving him from possible criminal proceedings and allowing him to retire with a huge pension in California. The establishment had cleansed itself of members of the club who had broken the rules, but it took some pains not to treat them too harshly. Those few who received jail sentences got short terms, were sent to the most easygoing federal institutions available, and were given special privileges not given to ordinary prisoners. Richard Kleindienst pleaded guilty. He got a $100 fine and 1 month in jail, which was suspended. That Nixon would go, but that the power of the president to do anything he wanted in the name of national security would stay, this was underscored by a Supreme Court decision in July 1974. The court said Nixon had to turn over his White House tapes to the special Watergate prosecutor, but at the same time it affirmed the confidentiality of presidential communications, which it could not uphold in Nixon's case, but which remained as a general principle when the president made a claim of need to protect military, diplomatic, or sensitive national security secrets. The televised Senate committee hearings on Watergate stopped suddenly before the subject of corporate connections was reached. It was typical of the selective coverage of important events by the television industry.